all the time going on websites to be able to navigate around if you didn't have the right Internet Explorer in that version of Windows you're running. So your best bet might be to just take the thing back to where you got it from and buy something a lot newer. Sometimes to be cheap is to be expensive.
Yes, I realize that, Joe. But maybe you don't know much about me. I'm in a motorized wheelchair. I lost both my legs due to complications with diabetes. I'm not very mobile. I did this mail order, and I'm going to write a letter to Staples. I wouldn't think Staples would do a thing like this. Instead of that, a fresh copy of Windows, you know, what first? By the way, these you guys know it's an elite book. An elite book by HP. I'm very, very disappointed. Back to that.
Anybody with any further comments for Rich? Please give me your call letters right now.
AC2GS.
Go right ahead, Roy.
I understand your problem, Rich, but unfortunately you bought a terrible lemon. The chances are that that fan isn't going to just work with lubrication either. The ball bearings are probably gone. It sounds like a mess. So I don't know what to tell you. The software is 17 years old. It might be fresh, but it's 17 years old. And chances are if you try and upgrade, none of the new drivers are going to work for a lot of the hardware in that thing, and the chip is probably slow as molasses. So I think, unfortunately, you're in between a rock and a hard place there.
Yes, I agree, Dr. Boyd. I'm not going to, believe me, I'm not going to throw good money after bad. I am going to send a letter, an email, to either the mom, Staples, right board of the corporate headquarters, and tell them I want a brand new one, that I'm very disappointed. And I don't mean a new one of these, something else more up to date.
Okay, good luck with that effort, Rich. Sounds like you found out quite a bit about how much that particular machine is not capable of doing. At this time, we're going to go over to Dr. Roy, AC2GS, and he wears about three hats. He can be the mail bag person, he can be the chat room person. He's also the person that headed up something that he started 3 or 4 weeks ago, which we can call science, physics, any of the technical subjects that are of interest to ham radio. Roy wears all those hats, and he's got a number of subjects he mentioned to me this week that he might want to go into, and all of those are good because we've gotten some very good feedback from the science/physics section of the TechNet. So we're going to continue it. The TechNet, as you know, what we do during it is primarily what you guys request. And so if the questions you get during the question and answer period are not interesting enough, well, it's a function of you guys asking interesting enough questions. So take it away, Roy, and any one of those hats you can put on right now, AC2GS, Dr. Roy, to take it, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Dick. Unfortunately, no one sent us anything in the mailbag this week, and no one left anything in the chat area this week. So I thought with all the conversation about digital televisions and the algorithms of codecs and such, I'd go back to something far simpler, like the nature of space-time and the speed of light. But before that, I just wanted to do a little bit of technical talk as far as how to reach me. I'm trying a new email address. Maybe I'll have better luck with that. So the new email address is mailbag@limarktech.net. Again, mailbag@limarktech.net. mailbag.net. So it's very easy to remember because it's the mailbag, and this is Limark Tech. You just have to remember to put a dot before the net. Also, something that I came across on YouTube might amuse some people. I was watching some video and I didn't stop it at the end, so it went on to the next video. And there was this guy ranting about how we waste energy all over the place. And one of the ways he figured out that he wastes energy is he looked in the back of his cable set-top box. And unfortunately, he misconcluded a whole bunch of things. He was looking for the power rating, like he saw on the refrigerator, but instead, he got the rating for his cable box as outlets that you can plug in a speaker system and a television set, and so he got the rated current that it would tolerate. So he decided that his cable box alone takes up 600 watts of electricity all day long whenever it's on. So he cautioned everyone on YouTube to please unplug it when you're not using your cable box, and he said that along with some other little things, he saved $60 a month. So it only goes to show you that you need a good Bravo Sierra meter when you're watching YouTube.
If that box was really consuming 600 watts, which is about half the amount of power of a toaster or half the amount of power of a hairdryer, he would feel a tremendous amount of heat above that thing. So he should have realized that that number is crazy. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, I don't think he knew anything about heat output of anything. He's just, it's amusing to see people kind of run with conclusions all over the place. But he had a nice little list that he drew up of the amount of electricity his toaster made and his refrigerator, and he repeatedly pointed out that his refrigerator burns only as much as his cable set box. So I never got to the end of it because I just laughed a lot and then I turned it off. But I was somehow he figured out enough things to drop his electric bill. But to this day, he and some people watching his YouTube think that a cable set-top box burns up 600 watts of power. I can't imagine what it would have to do to burn that much power. It would have to be a small supercomputer, I guess.
I just looked at the cable box here. It's funny. You can draw 400 watts out of it, but it doesn't tell you what it draws. It draws about 3 watts, so.
Comment.
WS2N.
Who said comment, and then Paul after that. Who said comment?
N1YDY.
N1YDY, go right ahead.
Yes, gentlemen, I couldn't help but laugh when you were talking about the 600 watts. It reminded me of a story many years ago. I was attending an airline ground school, which is a thing that airlines do when they hire new pilots and they have to make sure that they're up to speed on the airplane that they're going to fly. And to make a fairly short story shorter, there was an instructor who didn't quite understand the concept of what he was teaching, and he managed to express the heat output of a janitorial type heater, which is a device that uses jet fuel to create hot air and pass it around the cabin of an airplane that is not a pure jet aircraft. Usually you find these things on turboprops. But anyway, the guy had a 56,000 BTU heater, and he managed to think it was a 56,000 amp draw that it had on the aircraft, and you know, the aircraft's battery was only a 34 ampere hour battery at the inlet, so it's just sort of a funny thing. Reminded me of the story of the YouTube guy. Thank you, N1YDY.
If you turned on something with that heavy a drain on an aircraft, and the aircraft could really supply that power, wouldn't your nose strike the windshield because of the extra drag? Hank, go ahead.
I think that you wouldn't be able to get the airplane off of the ground. Simply the weight of the cables that would be required to support that type of a load would be ridiculous. And this was only a 15-seat turboprop airplane back in the 80s, you know, the kind that you went from the hub city to the small outlying cities. But it was just sort of a funny thing. They had an instructor who simply, he knew how to regurgitate numbers, but he didn't quite understand what they stood for. And, you know, of course, you couldn't laugh in the guy's face because I was sitting in the class, you know, as a student, but it was just one of those things that stuck in my mind. And one whitey white.
In my field of engineering, particularly with newly hired engineers who have a ridiculously strong faith in computer programs that can model everything, to run some kind of a computer modeling program where somewhere in the raw data they gave it and the program running does it almost divide by zero and comes up with numbers of the predicted antenna gain of 800 dB or something that's got a rejection of 920 decibels, which is 1 with 92 zeros after it as a ratio. Any number like that, because decibels are an exponential function. The number 900 is not a big number, but a number 900 in decibels is just out of sight. I mean, the loss to the most distant object in the universe that mankind has ever created, the Voyager spacecraft at 12 billion miles, is 300 dB of loss. It's at 12 billion miles. So they're not experienced enough to know that numbers that big are crazy and you don't believe it. Paul, WS2N, you had a comment?
Yeah, cable box from Optimum is on all the time. Whether you shut that off or on, put your hand over the top of that, you can feel heat. So, I mean, it just doesn't seem to change. Even if it's on, it doesn't feel any hotter. I mean, it's always about the same. I should hook up an amp probe to it, but my guess, it's got to be 20 watts. Back to you.
You've got it, right.
Okay, very good. AC2GX here. I also set up a couple of URLs. If anyone's interested in things that I'm talking about, I have them aliased so you don't have to go through a lot of slash, dot, word, dot, slash, double slash, what have you. So there's one website that some of you guys might find interesting. If you just point your web browser at nebula.slimark.tech, it's a little movie that I think NASA put together about a simulated program of nebula, and it's quite beautiful. So if you have the chance, take a quick look at it. It's a very nice thing to see. Last week we were talking about the speed of light, and the problem I think is that people think that the speed of light is somehow an inherent quality of light by itself, and so if something else travels at the speed of light, it's related in some way. In point of fact, apparently the speed of light isn't directly related to light, it's directly related to the concept of space-time itself, and there are different ways that you could conceive of the speed of light. You know, it's the rate of transfer of energy or information. It's the rate of causality. Anything that happens, the quickest it can hit you that it happens is related by the distance away by the rate of the speed of light. You can't be aware of it any sooner than that. So you can think of it in that way. You could also think of it like a complex number like impedance, the same way that impedance can have the imaginary number in the y axis and resistance in the x axis. You can think of it as speed in the three dimensions in the x axis and your speed traveling through time in the y axis. And the sum is always the same. Let me have it drop for a sec. So, if you're sitting in your chair, basically you're sitting in the same. The velocity is zero, so you're traveling completely in time. So the arrow is pointing straight up at 90 degrees on the time axis, and you're traveling through time. If you got on a rocket ship and flew away at an incredibly high velocity in relation to the frame of reference of your chair that you left behind, then think of it as the axis of the curve is going down from 90 degrees closer and closer to 0 degrees. And if you are able to reach close enough to the speed of light, effectively, you're not traveling in your own time. So the way it looks to you is everything around you has sped up. So it's sort of like a constant impedance with a different phase angle. So there's a lot of different ways of looking at the speed of light and its relation to space-time. That's my spiel about the speed of light. It's seen with, theoretically, with gravitons. It's seen with gravitational waves have been proven. It's believed to be the same case with gluons. Photons, gluons, and gravitons are all rest massless, and anything with a rest mass of zero is not slowed down to anything but the limit of causality, and so it all travels at the speed of light in a vacuum. But it's not because it's light or sort of light, but it's simply because there's nothing slowing it down. Weak nuclear forces have actual mass, so it gets slowed down, so it doesn't travel as fast as the speed of light. So that's my little spiel about the speed of light. What I thought might be interesting to talk about is this interesting metamaterial that was published recently that has a refractive index of almost zero, and what that means. And for Dick, you know, he can take it as a dielectric waveguide. It just happens to operate in the near-infrared. And the funny thing about something that's close to a refractive index of zero, it means effectively that the wavelength of the light is infinite, and the velocity of the light is infinite. So the question might be, how the heck can you have that if the speed of light can't be infinite?
I think you're going to give an explanation for that, Roy, and I have an explanation with reference to waveguide and phase velocity, which also can get a very big number, and what it really means. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, and that's why I thought it was a nice topic, because it meshes with waveguides and radio frequencies, and how could you go wrong with electromagnetic radiation? Anyway, this is a silicon material, and it's basically a dielectric waveguide. And the trick is that there's something called permeability and permittivity. And you can Wikipedia it if you want. It's the characteristics of electric fields and magnetic fields. And if you're able to use some kind of material that can bring the permittivity down to close to zero, you have a close to zero refractive index material. Unfortunately, you have to bring the permeability down too, because if you leave the permeability at any significant number, the impedance of the material becomes almost infinite, so you can't get anything into the waveguide. But these were very smart guys, and they came up with a way to decrease the permeability and the permittivity. And so they had this great thing. What happens is, as Dick mentioned, the velocity is almost infinite, but that's the phase velocity. Phase velocity has no information value. It doesn't tell you anything. It's an artifact. It's something called group velocity. That's the actual information-carrying aspect of the light, and that's still traveling below the speed of light. So they didn't break any rules as far as that's concerned. But they tested it in a very interesting way. Let me have it drop for a second. They set up their own standing wave by having two beams of light at both ends of this material. And they set up their own standing wave. Now, this is near infrared, so the wavelength is approximately 700 nanometers, which is a very, very small thing, which you really shouldn't be able to pick up with a microscope. And yet, they were actually able to pick up the peaks and the valleys using a standard microscope, because the material had stretched the wavelength so much that it was in the microscopic range that you could easily pick up with a microscope. they believe that refractive index is something like 0.02, which is still quite amazing to me. And the technology can be used for very weird things like cloaking devices. You know, you could cloak a person, a weapon, a ship, what have you. Theoretically, if you were able to build something big enough, structurally integral enough to get away with it. So I think this is a very interesting metamaterial, and it kind of confounds people's ideas that light can't travel faster than light in a vacuum. Some aspects of light can, some aspects of light can't. There are things in the world that can travel faster than the speed of light. Space itself can expand much faster than the speed of light. But any particle is limited, and any energy form is limited. So, over to you, Dick.
I'm a life member of the Microwave Theory and Technique Society, a division of the IEEE, life senior member to be exact. And for the last 10 years, a lot of research has gone on with what's called metamaterials, in other words, dielectric materials and magnetic materials that are so-called metamaterials. Metamaterials, Mother Nature, for the most part, has never made metamaterials. But human beings that group a whole bunch of resonators, step and repeat resonators, on top of each other, so to speak, very close spacing, in substrate materials of printed circuit boards, can synthesize something that has dielectric numbers, permittivity numbers that can be negative, positive, near zero, and the same thing with the permeability numbers. They can go all over the place. So you can get double negative material where the refractive index does the opposite. When you put a straw in a glass of water, because the water has a different velocity factor compared to the air, the straw looks like it makes a sudden bend where the straw enters the water. And if you are using doubly negative material, the bend of the straw will be in the opposite direction. And it's a little bit confusing. Let me drop it. But here's an example of I can tell you how a piece of waveguide works. In the case of a piece of waveguide, the signal doesn't go straight down the center of the guide like your optical signal does. The signal on every piece of waveguide being used in its recommended frequency region, the signal is bouncing back and forth, zigzagging between the narrow walls, very similar to what goes on in a barber shop that's got the mirrors on both sides. You look at the mirrors at a 45-degree angle, the last barber at the end, you'll see them four times in a row, if you know what I mean. The signal is zigzagging down the barber shop through the mirrored walls, and waveguide works exactly like that. As you go to a lower and lower frequency, approaching the cutoff frequency at the low end of waveguide, the zigzag angle becomes more and more shallow, and eventually the signal is bouncing back and forth between the two narrow walls and not propagating forward at all. At that exact frequency, you have this situation where the phase velocity is a huge number and the group velocity is a very small number. You're getting very little progress of the signal down the guide, but the phase velocity could be 10 times faster than the speed of light. And now I'm about to explain that. Let me drop. The best visualization I can think of this is a beach. Assume you've got a beach that's got a straight line where the land meets the water is a straight line. And your beach, when you're standing on land and you're looking straight out into the water, you're looking dead east. And now if a wave comes from the east toward your beach, when the wave crashes on the shore, it crashes at the north end, the south end, and in the middle at the exact same instant of time. There, it looks like the velocity of the wave crashing, if you're watching it, it looks like it's infinity. Well, now, let's bring the wave into the shore at a 5-degree different angle. Instead of coming in at 90 degrees, it comes in at 85 degrees. If you take the cosine of 5 degrees, which is one of the angles involved here, you'll end up with, I said cosine, I should have said tangent. Tangent of 5 degrees is something like 10 to 1. So in other words, if the wave comes in at 95 degrees azimuth, 5 degrees away from straight onto the beach, the wave will crash at the long end, at the north end of the beach, much before the south end of the beach. The wave might be really moving toward the shore at 1 meter per second, but you watch the wave crashing on the beach the crashing front on the wave will move from north to south on the beach at 10 meters per second. That's the equivalent of phase velocity. The real information, if each of your waves, if somebody was putting a colored water out there so that each wave was alternating between blue and red, the blue and the red waves would be moving toward the beach at 1 meter per second. That's the real velocity of propagation. Let me drop. But the crashing waves, which would crash first on the north end of the beach, and then you see the crash moving toward the south end, that's moving at 10 meters per second. That's the equivalent of phase velocity. It's a phenomenon that has an apparent wavelength to it, but there isn't information transmitting at that rate. The information of the wave crashing at the north end, it's a blue wave, and when it gets to the south end of the beach, it's the same blue wave that's crashing, but it occurred 10 meters per second of velocity across the beach. It wasn't the real velocity of information. The real information, the red wave versus the blue wave, is coming towards you at 1 meter per second. Well, that's sort of the difference between phase velocity in a waveguide and group velocity. If I'm running a piece of waveguide at very close to the cutoff frequency, it's going to take a long period of time for the signal to get down the waveguide. That's the bad news. The good news is that if I'm trying to create a phase reference where 100 feet away, I want that oscillator to be in phase with the oscillator that I've got in the shack with me. If I can set it up so that the phase velocity is a very fast number, it takes a while for the signal to get there. But once the signal gets there, the phase of the signal 100 feet away and the phase of the signal in the shack is almost the same. So I could use it for phase locking, so to speak. I still have to tolerate a very large amount of insertion loss. So you're not getting something for nothing. You got to be careful with this phase velocity versus group velocity. Information transmits at the rate of the group velocity. But the phase velocity is an interesting phenomenon, and not many cases, except for this example I just gave, can you really use it as something that seems to be moving faster than the speed of light. ACQGS, K2LIW, go ahead, Roy.
Yes, I mean, the whole topic to me is fascinating, at least. I mean, there are some cases where lab error is the cause for this misunderstanding that things are violating the speed of light. Only a couple of years ago at CERN, they had a loose connector, and they decided to publish prematurely that they found a neutrino that was traveling ever so faster than the speed of light, and they tightened their cables and shrugged their shoulders and moved on to something better. So that you know, sometimes it's just lab error, but sometimes it's not understanding what exactly people are seeing. And I'll offer this as an example and see if anyone is interested in picking it up and going with it. You take a very strong light and you illuminate the moon. Now you take an object, your finger, a pen, and you rapidly move the pen across your projector on Earth that's pointed at the moon, and it's so bright and powerful that it makes a shadow. Now, you can make that shadow travel at faster than the speed of light. So any ideas of why this is the wrong solution to this, conclusion to this thing?
Yeah, in theory, you could take a very strong laser pointer and wave it in azimuth, and you watch the laser pointer dot walk across the moon at faster than the speed of light. You can go from the left side of the moon to the right side of the moon, which is 2,000 some odd miles, and you can do that in a fraction of a second, maybe even a millisecond. Is that really propagating that fast? Absolutely not. If you modulated that laser pointer, and now you're looking at those, by some means you're looking at the individual bumps of modulation of the signal coming out of your laser pointer going toward the moon. Those modulated bumps are moving at the speed of light. The fact that you can make the waving motion at right angles look like it's faster than the speed of light, it's not really information propagating that fast. In other words, the information that hits the left-hand side of the moon and the information that hits the right-hand side of the moon is the exact same piece of information. It's not a new piece of information moving at that speed, if you know what I mean. So you got to be careful how you look at this. So when, when you're near the cutoff angles of things, like in waveguide, and in the case of waving a laser pointer across the moon, you're not breaking the speed of light. I don't think there's anything that they've ever measured that was what they call superluminal, in other words, moving faster than the speed of light. In the case of that neutrino experiment between CERN and Italy, where the path was something like 1,000 miles, let me drop this. They eventually discovered that it was instrumentation error that made it look like it was faster than the speed of light. They eventually figured that one out. People were worried that neutrinos could move faster than the speed of light. Very unlikely. The nice thing about neutrinos is that they can penetrate a tremendous amount of hard material. They're so darn small, they have no charge, they walk in between the empty spaces that's in every single molecule. Every molecule has got a tremendous amount of empty space. A helium atom, for instance, is about a nanometer in diameter, but the nucleus is 100,000 times smaller in diameter. And in between that outer couple of electrons, the path that they take, and that nucleus is nothing but empty space. So neutrinos can walk through there with no trouble at all. And so, and they only occasionally hit something. You may have heard that by using cosmic rays and neutrinos and whatever, they're now making the equivalent of an X-ray picture of the Great Pyramids in Egypt, and they've discovered that there is a empty chamber in the middle of the pyramid that needs further investigation. There may be another room in there that's not known after 4,000 years. AC2GS, KQLIW, go ahead, Roy.
Didn't Einstein say everything's relevant?
Yes. Anyway, space itself can expand faster than the speed of light. That's pretty much the only thing. And getting back to the laser pointer, I think it's even easier and simpler than the fact that it's not information that's new that's being transmitted faster than the speed of light. I think it's easier to keep in mind that you're not actually moving the light that's reflecting off of the moon from one end of the moon to the other end. You're projecting beams of light in a pathway across. So it's not light traveling across the surface of the moon. It's always light coming from your flashlight. And that's always limited by the speed of light. So although the illumination lights up a line that goes faster than the speed of light, that's not the actual speed of light. The speed of light is coming from your flashlight.
There's one other way of looking at this. You turn on your flashlight. If it's a very broad beam flashlight, and assume the moon is a flat surface. It has to be a sphere, but assume it's a flat surface. On the Earth, I turn on my flashlight. My light hits all of the moon at the same instant. In the case of that laser pointer, it's just a narrower version of my flashlight. The light coming out of my laser pointer is hitting the whole moon simultaneously. I'm just changing the portion that is the brightest. I'm moving the brightest portion of my laser pointer's antenna pattern, so to speak. I'm moving the main lobe of the antenna pattern from the left side of the moon toward the right side of the moon. But the real instant of turn-on of my laser pointer, although the light wasn't very bright on the right-hand side, it hit the moon on the right side at the exact same time that the light on the left-hand side, the bright portion, hit the moon. So I'm just changing which portion is brighter or dimmer. But the real information of the instant of turn-on that did move faster than the speed of light. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS.
Well, like they say, there's more than, you know, all roads lead to Rome, and there's different ways of looking upon it and proving it, and because it breaks down, and because it can travel faster than the speed of light. But I think the simplest approach, personally, is to realize where the vector for the velocity of the light is. It's not going from one side of the moon to the other. It's always from the point of view of your flashlight towards the moon. So that's not the same. The speed of the light traveling from your flashlight to any portion of the moon is traveling at the speed of light. It's this imaginary line that you're conceiving of that's running across the moon. That's not the velocity, because it's not the same light. And so it's a misperception in personally in the way I think of the puzzle.
Earlier, Paul, you mentioned, Roy, you mentioned that the space-time can move faster. And this is really the so-called period of expansion. After the Big Bang, in order to get the material into the right diameter, so to speak, in the right period of time, they have speculated, that there was a period of expansion where the material in the beginning moved faster than the speed of light apparent because the amount of time it had to get where it had to go was too short, so to speak. This is all based on the assumption that all the material was in one tiny little dot before the Big Bang. Very similar to the group of people who believe that inside of a black hole there is a singularity. All the material is at one little dot in the center of the black hole. I'm very skeptical about this. I'm going to tell you a couple of words as to why I'm skeptical. Let me drop.
WH4YY, put a question.
Okay, we'll go over to your question after I finish this little statement. The one of the strongest held pieces of information with reference to physics and science is conservation of mass, conservation of momentum, conservation of angular momentum, conservation of energy. You can't manufacture or destroy material. You can only change its form, change it from mass to energy, and so on. Okay. Every object in space, with rare exception, is rotating. Anything that's an accretion material, in other words, material had to fall into what you and I call the sun, and some of the material hit the sun at an angle, and the sun has some kind of rotation. Our sun rotates something like once every 27 days. Everything, with rare exception, rotates, except for things that are in a lockstep situation. Planets that are, a moon that's very near a planet sometimes.
Repeater, time out.
Our moon, for instance, is locked into the Earth, where one side always faces us. But except for situations like that, everything has a rotation. And the moon does have a rotation rate, roughly once every 28 days. Just that we also see it go around us, and therefore we only see one face. Conservation of angular momentum is required. So all the material that fell into that black hole created rotation. If the material was down to a single dot, and if it's going to conserve angular rotation, because moment of inertia is a function of diameter squared, and if you're going to take the diameter of the material in the center and make it go to zero, then you'd have to be, to conserve angular momentum, you'd have to be rotating at nearly an infinite rate. Craziness. On top of that, you have to conserve temperature. Temperature is really the average kinetic energy of the molecules. How fast they're moving. The air in the room with you right now, those air molecules, because they're at roughly 70 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly 290 some odd degrees Kelvin, they have to be moving at 500 meters per second, average speed, bouncing all over the place, but they're moving 500 meters per second. It is their speed that's being measured by your thermometer. Okay? Because the material falling into a black hole makes the black hole go up to some extremely high temperature, probably 10 to the 35 degrees. Doesn't matter if you talk about Fahrenheit, centigrade, Kelvin, probably 10 to 35 degrees. That's an extremely high velocity, very close to the speed of light. How can something be moving as fast as the speed of light, which is really some number of meters per second, so to speak, and have no distance to it? It's all a point. I think they're going to discover, eventually, that the center of a black hole, the material is not at a point. It has a distribution. Is a distribution Gaussian...
Repeater, time out.
Is that distribution uniform, Gaussian, Rayleigh? It doesn't matter. It is some distribution. I'm convinced that the material before the Big Bang was spread over some very large chunk of space. It was inside of an event horizon, but it was spread over some very large range. And by the way, you take the 10 to the 22 solar masses that existed before the Big Bang, and you calculate what was the event horizon. It happens to be something very close to the diameter of the current universe. So I'm having great trouble believing that all the material is down to a point. You'd have to be violating temperature. You'd have to be violating conservation of angular momentum in order to do that. And those laws, I don't think a black hole can violate those. W-H-L-I-Y, you had a question. Go ahead, Joe. H-L-I-W.
Okay, Dick. Related to the subject we were talking about, maybe I'll word it wrong, I'm not sure, but here it goes anyway. It may even sound like a stupid question, but that's okay, because you can entertain stupid questions on the deck net. From all the observations that have been made with the most, the best instrumentation that we have, we're noticing that particles in space, or parts of space, and objects in space, like planets, solar systems, and so forth, are moving away at a certain distance. Have they ever figured out geographically where the Big Bang started? From what point, physical point in space? Has that ever been established? Back to you.
I'm going to answer your question indirectly here, Joe. Assume right now you've got a huge cake that's being baked. Very large cake. And you and I live on one of the raisins that's in the middle of that cake. And because the cake has got some leavening in it, and as you cook it, the cake is expanding, every one of the raisins in that cake is all moving away from every other raisin by the so-called Hubble constant. So, you start off in one of those raisins in that batter, and they're all moving away from each other. By the measurements that you can make on the raisin that you're sitting on, can you figure out where the center of that cake was? From that raw data you have access to, I think the answer is no. You can't figure out where the center was. Or, every point that you think was the center is experiencing pretty much the same phenomena. Everything is moving away from you in all directions. So, you can almost say the Big Bang doesn't have a center. Was there really a center? Probably so. But by way of the raw data you have access to, I don't think you can find out where it was. That's a guess on my part. Let's see what Roy's going to say on this one. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
AC2GS. Okay, I'm going to take the diametrically opposite opinion and tell Joe that he is sitting, I assume he's sitting, at the very center of the universe. And Dick is sitting at the center, and I'm sitting at the center, and everyone listening is sitting at the center. Everything in the universe started out as the center of the universe. Think of it, if you want, as a four-dimensional surface of a balloon being blown up. So, everything's the center.
Okay. If all the material was at a singularity in the beginning, that would sort of fit. But to make that singularity, you have to violate a whole lot of other laws, as Roy says.
What kind of laws do you actually have to? I mean, I have a great deal of problems with the inflationary theory and the whole concept of the Big Bang, because you were mentioning mass-energy symmetry, the conservation of mass-energy, and unfortunately, the Big Bang kind of screws it as much as you can confuse the person. If you ask a lot of physicists what the total energy content of this universe is, they will tell you zero with a straight face.
Okay. Let's say we ask them the question differently. If I ask them what is the mass energy product of this universe, in other words, some of the material of the universe is material, which can be converted to energy. Some of this energy that could be converted to material. If I take the mass energy product of this universe, isn't that a finite, isn't that a calculatable number? And is it possible that calculatable number is a constant? The mass energy product of this universe has to be a constant, because there's no way the energy could leave this universe. Because the universe goes everywhere, if you know what I mean. Over to you on that one, Roy.
Yes, I would agree with you, and hopefully physicists would agree with you, that the mass energy of the universe is a constant. But the these guys trying to make inflation work will tell you that gravitational potential energy is a negative form of energy, and that if you add the negative energy to the positive energy and the mass energy, you come up with zero. So once again, these guys would, I don't know where they'd put their hand, I doubt a Bible, but wherever they would put their hand and tell you that the net mass energy of this universe is a big round zero. And I don't know, but I don't feel like zero. Do you feel like zero?
Not today. And Joe doesn't. Joe, you don't feel like zero, do you?
Not tomorrow either.
Along these lines, when they first started discovering a black hole in the center of some galaxies, they assumed that some galaxies had a black hole. And I remember predicting that that's crazy. To me, every galaxy is going to have a black hole. And that guess on my part turned out to be right. They're finding out every galaxy has got a black hole, a very massive black hole in the center. Now they're asking the question, which came first? Did the black hole make the galaxy? Did the galaxy make the black hole? Did the conversion, did the intercepts of galaxies create the black hole? Almost doesn't matter. Every galaxy has got a black hole. That's what holds it to center. And that's why they rotate like a wagon wheel as opposed to winding up like a spring, if you know what I mean. They were very perplexed by that for a while. They're still perplexed by the fact that most galaxies rotate almost as a wagon wheel and not as a wound-up spring. And they're using dark matter to try to explain that. I'm able to come up with a distribution of matter in a galaxy, including the black hole in the center, such that it'll rotate like a wagon wheel. You give me the right distribution, and it'll rotate like a wagon wheel. I'll give you a couple of examples on this. If all of the mass of the Earth was a thin shell at the outer surface of our Earth, if all of it was a uniform thin shell, and you walked inside of that shell, no matter where you are inside of that shell, you would sense zero gravity, because there's much above you, there's below you, to the left of you, to the right of you, and so on. You would experience either microgravity or weightlessness, so to speak. So there's the extreme case. I can make a galaxy where everything is a thin shell out of the perimeter, and now it's going to rotate like a wheel. I can now go the next step. I can take the correct distribution of material inside of that thin shell, and I can keep that weightless phenomenon, if you know what I mean, if I got just the right distribution. And by the way, if my thin shell has a little bit of lumpiness to it, even though I'm inside of the shell, I'm going to experience a little bit of outward gravity when I go near one of those lumps. Right now, I'm convinced there are multiple Big Bangs. There's a lot of material out there beyond our visible region, the amount of reason that we can see in the universe. Therefore, the material that's out there at the perimeter that's accelerating away from us, I think it's accelerating toward those bumpiness areas of the other Big Bangs that are out there. I'm predicting we're going to discover there were multiple Big Bangs. To think that there was only one, and we're in the middle of that one, that's very similar to, let me drop a stick. That's very similar to the five other kinds of arrogance that we have gone through, we as human beings. In the beginning, the Earth was the center of everything, and everything revolved around us. And eventually we discovered there's something called the Sun, and there's a solar system. And we wanted to believe the solar system was everything. Well, then we discovered the solar system is part of a galaxy. We wanted to believe that the galaxy is the only one there is, and we're in the middle of that one. Well, there is a local galactic group, and we're just one of the galaxies in that galactic group. Well, the galactic group is going to be everything. Well, there's now 10 to the 11 galaxies. So five times in a row we've been humbled. We're not the center of everything. We haven't been given any great emphasis, if you know what I mean. And so for us to think that this is the only Big Bang and we're in the middle of that, it's just a matter of time, I'm convinced, before we find out there are multiple Big Bangs, and we're going to be humbled at least one more time. That's a guess on my part. ACQGS, KQIW, go ahead, Roy.
And it's Rio.
Anyway, there's a couple of points that I want to get at. One is that no one really knows what the net angular momentum of the universe is. Yeah, you have to conserve angular momentum. But local angular momentum isn't necessarily global angular momentum. The same way that some of these physicists think that the net energy of the universe is zero, they probably think the net angular momentum is zero. And also, you're kind of stuck with this progression paradox. You know, if you think that we're a black hole that exploded, that then compressed to a black hole, that then exploded, that did that a few times, then the question is, when you go back to the very first black hole, where did the first black hole come from? So you always end up with this unfortunate regression paradox of having to explain the first one of a series of infinite cycles going along. And as far as the universe growing bigger, I'm more than happy to. I mean, I kind of like the idea of multiverses. I hope that it turns out to be a hyperdimensional multiverse that string theory talks about. That would be fascinating. So I perfectly would be happy to have something bigger than the universe.
WSON. Okay, we got Rich and Paul in that order. Rich, you want to make a comment?
Yes, I do, Dick. What you first brought up, and I know this anyway, energy can only be changed. It can't be destroyed. It can only be changed. But that brings up, I guess, some religious issues. When my mother died, about a year later, my father reported to me that my mother came to him and said, "I'm all right. I'm with all my friends." When me and Patty first got together, she fell down the stairs in Whitestone. And for whatever reason, she thinks my mother didn't like her, and it was my mother's ghost that kicked her down the stairs. I don't know. I mean, what about the fact that certain religions believe in reincarnation? This is all the religious beliefs. Maybe it's true. What do you think? Again, to you.
Yeah, I have no opinion on all of the above there, Rich, sorry to say. Haven't spent much time thinking on that one. Paul, WS2N, go ahead.
Okay, how about this one? Let's see what Roy thinks about this theory. You know, light will act similar to mass as it passes the star, will bend, gravity affects it. Well, that means light is a form of energy. What's happening with black holes? All the mass is going into the center, and inside the black hole, the mass is being converted to energy, pure energy, but it's so compact that the energy can't leave, but the equivalent of the gravitational pull is still there. Okay, so now you're always going to go to the other step of what happened before the Big Bang. Maybe there was no mass there, no little point of dot of all this mass into one little tiny point of dot. Maybe it was just pure energy, and that energy somehow converted back to mass. That created this whole inflation. What do you think, Dick? Maybe, Roy. Back to you, Dick. WS2S.
Yeah, Newton's equation of gravity leads you to believe that the amount of gravitational force, gravity force, is proportional to the masses of the two objects that are close to each other. So mass is required to get the force that we call gravity. If all the mass inside the black hole was converted to energy and the matter wasn't there, I don't think you would have gravity. I think the mass you put into a black hole, except for the drastic heating and radiation that takes place as it goes through the event horizon, I think the mass that goes inside the black hole is preserved forever, so to speak, except for the Hawking leakage that takes place. That's my guess on this one. I wonder if you agree on that one, Roy. I think the mass you put into a black hole, I think, is always there. AC2GS, K2LIW.
AC2GS. Well, again, the problem is that mass and energy are equivalent. They're easily convertible. So, for all intents and purposes, although it's difficult to see this in our world, mass and energy is pretty much the same. Now, there's two reasons, based on two different frames of reference, of why lensing occurs. One is that photons possess no rest mass, but they possess something that they are called momentum equivalent masses, and so that anything traveling at enough of a speed can have an effective momentum mass that operates on gravitational fields. Another group of people's attitude is that it has nothing to do with any of that, and it's simply the masses surrounding curved space-time, and the photon, in its mind, is traveling in a straight line. It only looks curved to you because you don't see the distortions of space-time gravitationally caused. So, two ways of looking at the same thing. You can't really tell what's in the core of a black hole, unfortunately, because once it gets past the event horizon, nothing's going to get past it. All the stuff in a black hole is not there eternally because there is radiation, Hawking's radiation, that dissipates it, but the Hawking's radiation decreases as the size of the black hole increases. The small black holes have a shorter lifespan, but big black holes can last for a trillion years. But they can diminish to a degree.
I'd like to believe that a photon has zero rest mass, but it has the equivalent of mass when it's moving. And maybe it only exists when it's moving. Obvious by the fact that you and I can put up a solar sail and get propulsion of a spacecraft in space out of it. The light hitting your sail, bouncing off of your sail, gives you a force. Now, when you set up a solar sail, are you really collecting a force because of solar wind, actual particles being boiled off from the sun, or the solar photon energy bouncing off the sail is giving you force? I think you're getting both. Which one is bigger, I'm not sure. But I think you do get a force out of light shining onto a mirror, a very small one, but I think there's a real force there that would suggest that the photons of light, when they're moving, they have the equivalent of, I'm not going to call it this, let's say that they've got some momentum. Oh, you're right.
Well, yes, I would agree, and that's the first theory that I gave you, that the way the physicists talk about it is it's momentum equivalent mass. You know, they suggest that the photon does have a momentum, as you suggested, and I agree with you, and then they infer a mass based upon that momentum, because most momentum is based on, you know, velocity times mass. So there's some kind of mass going on, whether it's virtual mass or whatever you want to put as a adjective in front of mass, but there's something there. So unless you want to go with pure curvature of space-time, and there are people out there who don't think gravity is a force, that gravity just warps space-time and everything is just moving in the lines that space-time is warping to, and we're kind of misconceiving the whole damn thing, and everything is either warped time-space or temporal or dimensional dilation. So these guys have their own little theory about all this. You know, that's probably why they suggest that there's going to be no theory for gravitational in the grand unified theory, because they suggest that there is no such thing.
Is there another subject that you want to get into, or do you want to continue with this one, Roy? Over to you.
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, Paul probably wants to get onto his space report, or if people want to discuss this more, I'm more than happy to. Whatever.
I have a question, something related to what you talked about, I guess.
Go ahead, Joe.
Let me twirl my watch. Let it reset. I'll be nice. Supposedly the GPS system has to correct for the timing error or time error because the satellites are far away from the center of the Earth. Is this correct? From what I understand so far, there's like a time, just a very small time error because they're away from the center of the Earth. This is correct.
Yes, it is. If you have two extremely accurate clocks and you're measuring the phase angle of the signal coming out of the two of them, there's a number of articles you can go to that'll tell you this. National Bureau of Standards have been doing this experiment. If I take the right-hand clock and raise